without going on any further, just introduce Dawn and say.
Thank you. So I'm a bit flustered. I thought I was on later and I've just been jabbering away and eating grapes. But so anyway, right, I think I'm together now. The understanding of the conversion and Christianisation of Scandinavian settlers in England is notoriously hampered by lack of direct written evidence. While material culture is useful, but it can provide only indirect perspectives, which are often chronologically imprecise. Not surprisingly, perhaps, discussion typically progresses a little further than grappling with the fate of the Anglo-Saxon religious infrastructure and trying to work out which churchmen and from where were facilitating conversion. Now, I'm not underestimating that these are absolutely fundamental considerations, but for today I'm going to set them aside, which will probably shock some of you, so do go and lie down in a darkened space if you feel you can't cope with that. But what I want to do instead is to think about people, the people being converted, rather than the institutions that made that conversion possible. I want to think about whether we can begin to explore the differential experiences of conversion and Christianisation according to gender and stage in the life cycle. In many ways, I think I'm going to be skirting around the issue of conversion directly. What I'm trying to do, however, is to establish something of the context of how men, women, and children experience the settlement process, and that might lead us some way towards understanding how conversion might have ensued. The focus of the paper is mainly on women and children in particular, but I'm going to start off briefly outlining what I see as the masculine dimension of conversion. Now, the most well-known and detailed account of conversion concerns, of course, Guthrum, who went with 30 of the most important members of his army to accept baptism following their defeat in 878, with King Alfred standing as sponsor to Guthrum. This appears to have had a profound effect on Guthrum, who subsequently ruled in East Anglia, in a fashion approximating that of an Anglo-Saxon king. He entered into a treaty with Alfred, he minted coins in his baptismal name, and his death was noted in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle in 890. The political dimension of the conversion of elite Scandinavian men is mentioned briefly in other accounts, such as the Chronicle reference to events in 943, when King Edmund stood sponsor to Olaf Sitrickson at baptism and then to Ragnar Guthrisson at his confirmation. Conversion was doubtless generally a price to be paid in the wake of political defeat to the Mercians and the West Saxons, but details are lacking. Nonetheless, the reference, for example, from 942 to the Danes of Mercia being in bonds of captivity to the heathens of the north prior to Edmund redeeming that region is at least suggested. But what happened next, after conversion, prompted by military and political considerations, goes almost entirely unrecorded. Nonetheless, I think that archaeological evidence can at least suggest that a dialogue of display articulated through masculine symbolism was an essential element in the mediation of acculturation and conversion. Well-furnished burials almost exclusively comprise masculine displays amongst the corpus that we have, and I think that's actually meaningful, not just a quirk of survival. And I think this reveals something of the role of masculine funerary display in the articulation of Scandinavian conquest and power. This may also apply to the appropriation of the church. Even if the presence of such furnished burials adjacent to churches scarcely provides any indication of conversion as such. A similar emphasis on elite masculine display can be identified on coinage as well, minted for Scandinavian rulers, especially in York. Now, that leaves open the question of when, why, or even if individual Scandinavian rulers have converted, but I think the funerary and the numismatic record presents a picture of elite men whose status was expressed through a mixed repertoire of symbols. Coins, for example, depict weaponry and symbols with potential pagan resonance, of Thor's hammers, for example. But they also employ Latin, crosses, a Carolus monogram, the name of local saints, religious inscriptions, and baptismal names. Burials, for their part, sometimes incorporated Anglo-Saxon or Carolingian weaponry and belt fittings, occasionally Anglo-Saxon coins. Well, the sculptures that proliferate in northern England in the 10th century combine Christian, secular, mythological imagery. There are similarities, clearly, between the array of artefacts found in the more elaborate male graves and those depicted on the sculptures, where we see a proliferation of secular figures, mainly male, as are the identifiable mythological figures. These sculptures are nonetheless seemingly more closely related than are the burials, of course, to the processes of integration and conversion. And of course, there's no necessary contradiction between Christianity and the aristocratic martial ideal. And it appears that warrior imagery on 10th century stone sculptures reveals that the church had, as it always manages to do, strategically adapted itself to the aristocratic environment, although doubtless there would have been those churchmen who would have disapproved. The significance of mythological figures on sculptures such as Wayland and Sigurd is debatable. But I don't think we should underestimate the capacity of those who commission sculptures to have purposely requested imagery that was capable of eliciting diverse responses, and thus for such heroic figures to have served simultaneously as commemorations of Scandinavian traditions, as didactic aids in the processes of conversion, and as reflections of specifically masculine aspirations. I think that this material record suggests that the processes of settlement and acculturation involved the Scandinavian elite looking to the Scandinavian past by drawing on familiar imagery and symbols, but also adopting material culture forms with contemporary resonance for newly established elites, in the form, it seems, of symbols of lordship familiar to Western European Christian rulers. Now, of course, none of this directly reveals anything about conversion to Christianity per se, but I think what it does do is begin to highlight some of the strategies adopted as Scandinavian rulers established their positions within parts of northern and eastern England, and in some cases drew on the legitimacy that the church could offer. Whether or not that's the same thing as conversion doesn't matter. Yet, okay, I've written about that in print before, but we have to remember that that is only one part of the story, one part of the narrative for Scandinavian men. For example, alongside this coinage-based economy with those interesting combinations of symbols, a barter economy persisted for a generation or more. While masculine funerary display, emphasising warrior prowess, is certainly known, it was clearly restricted. We're getting stable isotope evidence for individuals from Scandinavia in entirely unfurnished graves, but it's most clearly evidenced, I think, at Repton, where only one of the two males in a double burial was afforded a weapon assemblage. And it's a provision that seems to me to have been determined both by his greater age and the fact that he appears to have met a particularly violent death. And of course, it's well known, this lovely little packet of amulets is placed between his thighs near to a particularly nasty looking groin area weapon injury. So it seems almost to be kind of compensating for loss. The importance of weapons, armour and hunting to lordly status was of course scarcely an innovation. But of course there's nothing inevitable about the appearance of such images on sculpture. And it may just reflect something of the ways in which the church provided a context for the expression of martial identity, perhaps amongst the native elite as well as Scandinavian newcomers, but only in certain circumstances. And it's notable, I think, that such masculine military displays and sculpture are rarely found in the towns of the region from which Scandinavian and subsequent West Saxon rule seems to have been based. It's been suggested by David Stocker that concentrations of stone funerary monuments in trading places may have been the product of competitive display between merchants. And if that's right, then it's perhaps not surprising that martial imagery was unnecessary, if not downright inappropriate in such contexts. And in those environments, Christian imagery in the form of crosses on the sculptures predominated. So in some way, we may just be seeing here, I think, the diverse array of responses among Scandinavian men, and perhaps their local counterparts as well, to the circumstances of settlement and conversion. Now, so far, that's all, if you know the period, reasonably familiar evidence, as I've skirted around the issue of conversion. But I think what emerges, nonetheless, is that there is an emphasis on masculine identity in a variety of elite contexts, which accords, that happens, with the focus of much, but not all, of the documentary record, that at the same time, warrior masculinity was restricted in forms of display. Now, what I want to do now, for the rest of the paper, after that very brief summary, is to focus and to consider the evidence that we have for the experiences of women and children of conversion. It's not much evidence, but there's some. And even when you don't have a lot of evidence, I think sometimes it's worth asking questions that are difficult to answer, because it can help you to maybe challenge some of the assumptions you're carrying around without thinking about them. Now, the roles that they may have played and the experiences that they may have had are hinted at most clearly in a series of events recorded in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle entry for 893. The wife, or woman, perhaps, and two sons of the Viking leader Hastun were taken from the Viking stronghold at Benfleet to King Alfred, but they were released because one of the sons, it transpired, was his godson, and the other was the godson of Ealdorman, Ethelred. The baptism of the sons had, we are told, occurred at some unknown time prior to the arrival of the Viking army at Benfleet, when Hastun had given the king oaths and hostages, and the king had also made him generous gifts of money. This had not, however, prevented him from subsequently ravaging Ethelred's Mercia. Nonetheless, doubtless motivated by the bonds of spiritual kinship that he'd established with Hastun and his family, Alfred allowed his captives to go free. And he apparently made another endowment when he gave back the boy and the woman. Now, the account of this rather peculiar turn of events in an unusually detailed passage suggests that perhaps behind the more typically brief statements in the chronicle about battles won and lost, the processes of acculturation and conversion may have commenced, and that from an early stage, this involved women and children. Now, the ethnic and the religious composition of the family of Hastun is debatable. His wife, or woman, was not necessarily Scandinavian, given that it's the sons, not the wife, who were referred to as being converted. She may have been English, but Hastun had apparently not been in England long. And so if she was the mother of the sons, which isn't absolutely clear, it may be more plausible to deduce that she was from Francia, where Hastun had previously raided. Either way, she would have been Christian. Hastun's probably to be identified with the Viking leader Alsting, who was active on the Loire in 882. He was encouraged by King Louis III to move to the Channel coast, later establishing a base on the River Somme and allying with the Abbot of Saint-Vaast in Normandy, before then attacking that monastery. It's possible, but far from certain, that he'd converted in Francia, although his sons had apparently not done so. Whatever the case, and we don't know, once in England, Hastun's sons became enmeshed in, use the word Sam was using earlier, in local political networks in which Christianity was crucial. And it appears from the chronicle entry that baptism was serving, as so often, to reinforce political ties and the forging of peace. Indeed, and perhaps because of their mother, the sons may have been deemed more reliable potential allies than their evidently duplicitous father. This family was seemingly, potentially ethnically mixed, and at least only partly Christian. And they were living amidst an army that was also probably ethnically, if not religiously, diverse. And I think this has to prompt us to ask about the implications for families living in such circumstances. Of course, early medieval pagan and Christian communities had divergent perspectives on marriage, on sexuality, on reproduction and family. And therefore, it leads us to think that complex layers of group and personal negotiation must have been occurring among and on behalf of women and children, even during warfare. There's another apparently young convert amongst the sons of Viking warriors, Odda, who later became Bishop of Ramsbury and then Archbishop of Canterbury. According to the life of St. Oswald, written by Bertworth of Ramsey, Odda's father was a Dane who'd raided eastern England in the late 9th century. Yet, apparently, Odda developed an early a zeal for church going, despite the threats of his father, who did not wholly seek to serve Christ. In order to pursue his Christian leaning, Odda, the boy of God, left home to be educated in the household of a certain venerable thane, one who believed faithfully in God by the name of Ethelhelm, with whom he enjoyed the blessing of fatherly love. Now, this account of the early life of Odda indicates, I think, if it's in any way reliable, the importance of the church in the acculturation of the children of newcomers to Anglo-Saxon society. And Odda was seemingly not alone in his experiences, as Asser comments on a man of pagan, presumably Scandinavian origins, who'd been brought up in the monastery at Athelney. He was, as quite a young man, living there in the monastic habit, and was assuredly not the last of them to do so. Asser also records that Alfred had acquired individuals of Gallic origin and ordered that certain of their children be educated in the monastery and at a later time be raised to the monastic order. Now, these individuals of Gallic origin had possibly been taken into slavery by Viking raiders on the continent and subsequently brought to England. From these accounts, the monastery emerges as an ethnic melting pot in which children were central to new religious and political developments and to the broader acculturation process. And of course, ablation would offer an important means of promoting alliances between families and with the church, and it also offered a means of support and protection for children in these violent times. And I think this would have been particularly important if their parents were either dead or else newcomers with poorly established networks of patronage. The account of Odda's early life also emphasises the importance of fosterage, and there are hints from other, admittedly even later sources, of fosterage being important in the context of Scandinavian interaction with the British elite, including Athelstan's supposed fostering of Harkon's son of Harald Finehair, and the reference from Landnamabok to Orliga Herpsen, a relative of Kettle Flatnose, having been fostered by an unknown, otherwise unknown, holy bishop Patrick of the Hebrides. The age at which someone like Odda left home is unclear, but the fostering of sons in early medieval elite households appears typically to have occurred when a child was 7 or 8 years old. It was an important means of forging alliances among aristocratic families, and there's just this hint here that it may have been employed in the wake of Scandinavian settlement as alliances would form between the rulers of the newcomers and the local population. The role of younger Scandinavian settlers in political accommodation also emerges potentially from a strange account in the Historia de Sancto Cuthberto, concerning the events surrounding the peace forged in the 880s between a Viking army raiding in the north of England and the religious community of St Cuthbert. Inspired by a vision from the saint, as all good abbots are, the abbot went to the army and suggested that they go to a certain boy, Guthred, son of Harthacnut Canute, who is the slave of a certain widow, and make him king. The ensuing coronation ceremony combined pagan and Christian elements. It took place at a hill associated with a 7th century Christian king of Northumbria, and it involved the giving of a gold armlet, which seems to have been a sort of pagan symbol of office. We know little of Guthred's early life, but while later Durham sources certainly need to be treated with caution, it may be significant that they claim that Guthred was the son of a king and had been sold into slavery by the Viking army. That the monks were instrumental in his election as king certainly suggests that Guthred was a particularly notable captive. And his experiences, if indeed they're true, with the Viking army at a young age may have made him appear particularly susceptible to overtures from the most prominent religious community in northern England. Now, of course, in none of these cases concerning the sons of Viking raiders do we know their precise ages. The terminology is quite loose here. The sons of Hasten are simply referred to as Sonu, Son, Bjarnum, children. The term puer, which is used for both Odda and Guthred, was capable of being employed in a variety of ways in early medieval Latin texts, but sometimes retaining its classical meaning of boy or child. Certainly in late antiquity, pueritia was understood as the period from about 7 to 14, while infantia was the period up to the age of 7 years. So although we can't at all determine the precise age of any of these aforementioned individuals, the terminology employed and the context of the event described suggests that they were not fully socially adult, at any rate, and perhaps in many cases may have been older children on the cusp of adulthood, which probably in this period would put them in the age bracket of somewhere between about 8 and 12 years. Certainly I wouldn't think any older than that, and I certainly don't think there's an army of toddlers marching across Viking Age England, just in case that strange image was coming into your mind. So we've got a very brief record here, but with fleeting glimpses only. But the accounts of the sons of Hastun, Odder, Guthred, and the Oblates at Athelney reveal, I think, that the younger members of the migrant communities were potentially playing quite an important role in the processes of acculturation. These accounts might just hint that the young were targeted by the ecclesiastical and secular elite as they set out to convert the settlers. I thought it was an interesting parallel there with Liz's paper this morning. Conversion could offer the young opportunities to advance their social standing, that seems to appear from the text, but at the same time it was clearly a risky strategy, liable to end in alienation from at least some members of their own family and community. Now, in the background of all of this, I think there begins to emerge an issue about the role of intermarriage in mediating conversion. Anthropological parallels would certainly suggest to us that the earliest phases of migration, even in a non-military context, are likely to comprise disproportionate numbers of young adult males who were typically more capable of leaving their homelands to exploit new opportunities by military force if need be. If so, marriage with local women must often have been a corollary and significant in the acculturation process. Indeed, intermarriage was certainly sometimes a product of diplomatic negotiation. For example, following a meeting in 926 at Tamworth between King Athelstan of Wessex and the Scandinavian ruler of York, Sitrick, the latter was married to Athelstan's sister. There are other cases where intermarriage can be inferred right the way across Britain and Ireland from the record of families in texts and on sculptures with both Scandinavian and indigenous names. Now, of course, not always would such marriages produce children, and indeed the absence of children could be a factor in their failure if it stemmed from differing attitudes towards sexuality and religion. I mean, if we can trust Roger of Wendover, this may have been a factor in the failure of Sitrick's marriage, as his wife is said to have preserved her chastity until she was set aside, after which she joined a nunnery. Where children were born into mixed ethnic unions, it must have had profound implications for them as they grow up. This has attracted surprisingly little comment. Yet the children of mixed ethnic marriages lived out the reality of the ensuing acculturation experiments in their lives, in contrast to the abstract realms in which such matters are often discussed. Now, we don't have any... We don't have any reliable or detailed insights from the Viking Age, but there is a later perspective we might turn to for the implications of intermarriage between individuals of different ethnic backgrounds. From the writing of the chronicler Audric Vitalis, born in 1075 near Shrewsbury in the Midlands, who had a French father and an English mother. At the age of 10, again that sort of age, older childhood on the cusp of adulthood, he was sent by his father to a monastery in Normandy, where, in his own words, he felt like an exile, unknown to all, knowing no one. His isolation compounded by an apparent inability to speak French, despite his father's origins. As the offspring of a mixed ethnic union, it was evidently his mother that had been decisive in determining his language acquisition. Moreover, despite having a French father and spending his adult life in Normandy, Audric repeatedly identified himself as English in his writing. And that's striking at a time when chroniclers were perfectly capable of identifying themselves in various ethnic ways according to context, and irrespective of either language or place of birth. Children of ethnically diverse households doubtless had to negotiate the tensions that this must have created. In a sense, such individuals had to negotiate the transition to their adult gendered roles in the face of competing traditions and notions of acceptable behaviour. How much more complex must this have been if it involved not only a negotiation of contrasting constructions of ethnic identity, but if it also required a change of religion, and a different one from that of one or both of their parents. Now, it's possible to draw very, very tentatively on archaeological evidence to take this discussion further, but this does require me to widen my perspective, and you are right, this is the point where I've run out of evidence, but anyway. Amongst those Furnish burials that reveal Scandinavian influences, the burials of females are fewer in number than their male counterparts, and the burials of children are even more rare. Nonetheless, some interesting contrasts emerge. The burials of adult females, particularly those from the Scottish Isles, but also the odd English examples such as that from Addicliffe Street in Yorkshire, include a mixture of material culture, some of Scandinavian type, but some of indigenous, particularly Western British and Irish type. And it raises various questions. Were they women of local origins and therefore Christian, but had adopted, perhaps following marriage to a Scandinavian man, some of the trappings of Scandinavian identity in the form of their costume, and then were buried in a manner that reflected their life course? Or were they women of Scandinavian origins and their burials reflected the adoption of aspects of local traditions and material culture? Particularly here, including items that seem to have had some sort of Christian resonance, albeit taken out of context, such as fittings from wooden objects, possibly reliquaries, reused as here as brooches. Now, perhaps the most complex female furnished burial from the British Isles of this period is that from Peel Castle on the Isle of Man. This is an adult female buried in a pre-existing cemetery of Lintel Graves, Christian cemetery, and she was placed in the grave wearing or accompanied by a necklace of beads and a copper rod, knives, shears, a comb, an iron spit or rod, a bird's wing and plant remains, copper alloy needles and copper alloy strips in a textile pouch, an ammonite fossil, amber and jet beads, and a miniature pestle and mortar. Mineralised textile remains reveal that she was buried in clothing comprising of at least five different plain weave woven fabrics, two or three types of cord, a tablet woven sash, and a finer fabric at the face, possibly acting as a veil or a shroud. It's also notable that she was physically distinctive, displaying significant signs of vitamin D deficiency in the form of rickets, which would have had quite an impact on her legs and on her gait. Now, vitamin D is present in food, but only in small quantities, and therefore most vitamin D is synthesised by the body following exposure to sunlight. The osteologist Simon Mays has argued recently that the occurrence of rickets in the past often indicates an inadequate exposure of the skin to natural light. And in the light of that, I think it's striking at the very least that this female was buried with multiple layers of clothing and a possible veil. Did she occupy some distinctive role in society, perhaps leading to and deriving from her physical characteristics? Was she a pagan Scandinavian? Well, maybe, but not necessarily so. It's not a classic Scandinavian grave. Many of the artefacts included in this grave seem to have had an amuletic quality, which might conceivably be acceptable in either a pagan or a Christian context, although admittedly it's unparalleled to find such a collection in a Christian grave of the 10th century. Does this grave reflect something of the potential of females to have played some sort of significant religious role? Would, and I'm thinking also about the Scottish burials with those kind of religious liturgical items in them, would this have made them, were they seen as particularly susceptible to the virtues of religious change, or at least seen in, by churchmen as susceptible in that way? At any rate, whatever the case, female graves reflect something more than the identities linked to military and political status that are typical of male graves. Now, there are very few examples of children's graves that we can look at, but these are also striking. The burial of a sort of 10 to 12 year old at Balnakeel in Sutherland in Scotland was accompanied by weaponry, clothing, accessories, gaming pieces, a brooch of Irish manufacture, but also needleworking and fishing equipment. The varying date ranges of the artefacts included that have been suggested that some of them were heirlooms. There's a mixture of Scandinavian and indigenous material culture, which has something in common with female graves, but also items that have masculine and feminine associations. At one of the burial mounds at Heathwood in Ingleby, which largely seem to have male burials, there is one mound that has a female and a juvenile in it, child in it, has remains of a sword hilt grip and the iron clamps from a shield rim. So artifacts that you would more normally find adult male graves, perhaps associated with the juvenile in this case. Another striking burial occurs not far away at Repton, where a Viking age grave contains the remains of three children aged 8 to 10 years and an adolescent aged about 17 years. It was excavated at the edge of the mound that sealed a former mausoleum in which a mass burial deposit had been placed towards the end of the 9th century. This has been interpreted as a sacrificial deposit, although the skeletons offer no specific evidence concerning manner of death. It does also, moreover, appear to have been distinguished by a grave marker, perhaps some form of closing deposit associated with the larger striking funerary deposit. It's very difficult to understand this burial, but it does seem to have been a significant element in that broader political statement about the conquest by the Viking army of this very important Mercian religious site. Okay, well, just to pull some thoughts together now, because I'm starting to stray a bit. I was actually quite influenced in my thinking on this and trying to tease anything out about children in particular by some work on migrations by anthropologists and sociologists. And although they may not be directly relevant to us, they do show us the way in which children are not just sort of passive vessels, but can actively negotiate the processes of acculturation. They can act as mediators of cultural interaction and assimilation. They may prove better at adapting to language change and creating new networks of acquaintances. Modern parallels show us the way in which younger members of communities can extend adult social networks in new situations. It does also make us stop to think about how cultural norms might have been passed on to children if they were simultaneously, as well as experiencing their family and its norms, exposed to new environments. So in sum, it seems to me that it's highly likely that individuals would have experienced conversion in varying ways, according not only to their social, political or economic position, but also according to gender and stage in the life cycle. And I think in this paper I've only really nibbled at the edges of the issue of conversion, but I hope to have begun to show that we can tease out, I think, even if, from familiar evidence, a tentative picture of the differential experiences of conversion for at least some of the settlers according to gender and stage in the life cycle. Thank you.